5 a.m.
October 3rd, 1955. A ship known as the MV Joyita leaves Samoa, setting out for the Tokelau Islands. The voyage had been expected to take between 41 and 48 hours. On the 6th of October, the Joyita was reported overdue. No distress calls were ever received. 5 weeks later, a merchant ship sighted the Joyita more than 970 kilometers west of the scheduled route. The ship was partially submerged and listing heavily. There was no trace of any of the passengers or crew. None of the 25 souls aboard were ever found. To this day, the details surrounding the demise of the ship and the fates of those aboard remain a mystery.
Featuring Joe Sweeney from Thinking Sideways Podcast and filmmaker Vincent Calderney. This is The Shocking Details.
Hey there. Welcome to another episode of The Shocking Details. I'm Joe, joined by Yo. And this week we are back with another fascinating story and a mystery. This is a maritime mystery. Yeah, it's about a ghost ship.
It is, and it's a fascinating ghost ship story,
too. It's really an interesting story, and it's one of my favorites, actually. And so, if you listen to my old podcast, Thinking Sideways, we mentioned this one briefly years ago. We did an episode called Lost Boats Found, I believe was the title of the episode.
That was the title of it. I remember this episode. It's a good episode.
Yeah, it was about boats and ships that showed up in odd places that didn't really make sense, and it was all mysterious and stuff, right? And, you know, but we only talked about the Joyita for maybe 15 minutes, and that really didn't do the story justice. I felt bad ever since, to be honest with you.
Can I just highlight for a minute how nervous I am that we're now taking on Thinking Sideways?
I know.
We're gonna get our butt kicked here.
But. I know we're taking not just Thinking Sideways. We're also taking on Generation Y because they covered this story years ago.
They did, yeah,
yeah. And so I encourage our listeners to listen to our treatment of the story and then go listen to Gen Y's treatment.
It's all good stuff.
If you think that they did a better job, then by all means, let us know. We will take this episode down and we will burn it.
I'm not doing that.
Does that sound fair? Okay.
You do that, can I have your ad revenue?
I'm making this thing called an empty promise. Don't tell anybody. Okay.
you are full of them.
All right.
So let's get into the MV Joyita.
Yeah, tell us, give us quickly an intro about the MV Joyita.
Sure. So the MV Joyita has been called the Mary Celeste of the Pacific. The Mary Celeste also was a Thinking Sideways episode, if I recall correctly.
We did do an ep about that. Yeah, yes, we did.
It's a really famous one. I won't go into the Mary Celeste. It is a fascinating mystery itself.
Oh, hell yeah.
But yeah, this is not just us saying this. This actually was from Life magazine, actually from their December 12th, 1955 issue. You want to read us this quote here, Joe?
Yes.
Not since 1872, when the brigantine Mary Celeste was found under sail in the Atlantic with not a soul on board, has there been a maritime riddle to equal the one posed by the finding of the Joyita.
That's good stuff.
Ooh, yeah.
Just for a quick history of our ghost ship, the Joyita was first built in 1931 as a private yacht, and it was actually built by a Hollywood director named Roland West.
Wow.
He was pretty well known in his time.
I think he kind of specialized in horror flicks and stuff.
He did some of that stuff. Yeah, horror. But he was pretty prolific.
Yeah, by the way, if you want to know what the name came from, it means little jewel. Joyita means little jewel in Spanish.
Right.
And his wife's name was Jewel. So that's how the boat came to be named Joyita. Yeah.
She was the big jewel, and he was the little.
Yeah.
It was the little jewel.
Yeah, I guess
the boat
so.
Was the little jewel.
The boat was the little jewel. Boat. Yeah.
Right. So it's
a 16. About our boat, though. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's a 69 foot long, 17 feet abeam boat. The hull was 2-inch thick cedar planks on oak framing. So this is a solid boat.
They don't make them
like that anymore, really.
Nah, not at all. Yeah, that's 2-inch thick. Wow, that's a solid boat.
It's nice.
And by the way, the Joyita saw some action in World War II, believe it or not.
It did.
Yeah, the Navy took her, and I don't know if they did what they call a mandatory buyback or what they did, but they basically requisitioned the boat, bought it or something, and she was stationed at Pearl Harbor. And right. I don't know if she was in port when the Japanese attack occurred, but that is where she was stationed. And she was stationed there at the time of the attack. But the Navy used her to patrol the Big Island until the end of the war, I guess, to stop infiltrators or something, mm-hmm. I guess. And but in 1943, while still under Navy ownership, the Joyita underwent some repairs, and most of the piping was replaced with that fancy new galvanized iron stuff. You've probably heard of that stuff, right?
Yeah.
Which has, of course, proven very successful at withstanding corrosion, as we all know.
Nice.
And this decision to replace the old pipework, which I assume the old pipework was copper or brass, this was a fateful decision, but more on that later. Yeah.
We will get back to that.
Yeah.
So after World War II, the Navy sold the boat and it was refitted to carry cargo. The ship's hull was lined with a heavy layer of cork for insulation, and refrigeration equipment was installed. The addition of cork gave the boat so much buoyancy that it basically became unsinkable. Mm-hmm. Which is something, I mean, I'd like to have that.
That's a handy feature. You know,
right?
Yeah, the total amount of cork that was added to the boat, I read in one authoritative source, was 640 cubic feet of of that, which basically is a piece of cork, 8 foot by 8 foot by 10 foot. So that would keep our boat afloat. I mean, it wouldn't have stopped the Titanic from sinking.
No.
But it would keep most boats from sinking, including the Joyita, I think.
Mm-hmm.
That's a big cork, don't you think?
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
Yeah.
So the Joyita changed hands a few more times, and in 1952, it was bought by Catherine Lumala of Hawaii. Apologies if I get that name wrong. I looked it up, but I'm not sure I'm getting it right.
Yeah, close enough.
She leased the boat to a friend of hers named Thomas H. Miller, a Welshman. He was from Wales and he was living in Samoa. Thomas went by the nickname Dusty, and he used the boat for inter-island passenger and cargo runs, and also as a fishing charter boat.
Just whatever was paying that day. But so our boat, the Joyita's fateful last voyage, began on October 3rd, 1955. About 5 a.m. that day, Captain Miller took her out of the Apia Samoa Harbor. And Apia is actually Samoa. I don't know if you know this. Samoa is basically two large islands and a few smaller little bitty ones too. So okay. Apia is on the eastmost island.
Gotcha.
And
okay.
It's on the north shore of that island. Okay. So anyway, they leave Apia heading northward for the Tokelau Islands, which were about, now it were and still are, 270 miles.
The islands didn't move.
Well, they might have moved a centimeter or two due to, like, you know, tectonic plates and all that stuff.
But they're not
pretty,
in Ohio right now.
Yeah, no. But they're about 270 miles north of Apia. And at the time they left, there were 25 people on board the boat, including 16 crew and 9 passengers, which is...
okay.
Yeah, it's a lot of crew, by the way, but whatever, you know.
Yeah, that's interesting. I guess I'm not totally able to picture this boat. I mean, I've looked at pictures of it. 16 crew seems like a lot.
It really does. You know, and I don't know what this was. I mean, maybe these were the friends of Dusty's, and he was giving them like sort of make work jobs where he paid them next to nothing, but they could claim they'd be getting some deckhand experience or something like that, so they could go on and get a job somewhere else. I don't know.
I was wondering if maybe it had something to do with, I don't know, or something like sometimes... like deadheading, right? Like that you'd have people on there who are technically there as crew, but all you were doing was really transporting them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right. They wouldn't be paying passengers. It just seems like a lot. So I just want to put that out there.
That is a good point. You know, maybe that's a way, if you got 9 paying passengers and you're giving free rides to a few of your friends or some other people, and you don't want to offend the paying passengers, you claim that these people are crew. I see what you're saying. Yeah. Yeah. That makes sense. Yeah. Yeah. So that's, but anyway, so 25 people total, but none of those people were ever seen again.
None of them.
None of them. Not a single one.
Mm-hmm. Oh. It's also worth mentioning that the Joyita left Samoa on one engine because her port engine clutch had failed.
Mm.
The engine was running just fine, but couldn't turn the screw because the clutch had been disassembled and parts for repair, they were not readily available.
Not surprisingly, really, right?
Samoa, especially 1955, is pretty remote. So if you need a really specific part, it may not just be laying around the island.
Probably not, yeah.
So that may seem a little foolhardy to take to sea with just one functioning engine, but I think we're guessing that Captain Miller and crew assumed that the starboard engine crapped out. They could always just repair the port side clutch with parts from the starboard clutch and just finish the journey on the other side.
Yeah, I assume that's
something like that.
So as long as it's the clutch itself that doesn't fail, then you're golden, right?
I guess.
And if the clutch itself is what goes out, then you're really, really screwed. But
yeah. I mean, I guess you would also say, like, hearing this, like, if I was on this boat, I'd be like, oh, I'm a little nervous. But how many boats probably are fine to sail a voyage like that and just have one engine?
Yeah, I don't know. I think people, this was post-World War II. People were used to kind of living on the edge and stuff. So, and they probably figured, hey, this is a regular shipping route. So somebody will come along and save our bacon. Plus we've got a radio. We can call for help.
Noting that they weren't, I mean, they were out in the middle of the ocean, but it wasn't like they were in the dead middle of the Pacific or some weird place like that. They were within radio contact at every point in their journey, right? There was no place where they were not able to hail another ship or an island or something, right?
Well, we'll get into that.
Okay, let's get into it.
It's, hypothetically, yes, but in reality, right. Maybe not quite so much. Yeah,
and the plan was that they wouldn't be out of radio contact.
Yeah, according to everything that they knew at the time. Yeah, but it didn't necessarily shake out that way. But so we got here. Besides the crew and the passengers, Joita was also carrying some cargo, mm-hmm. medical supplies, some timber, 80 empty 45-gallon oil drums, and some food. I'm not sure how much, but included a fair amount of meat, apparently. So I must surmise, therefore, that the refrigerated hold was working fine.
I think so.
In addition to the food, there was, of course, just food for the crew and the passengers. That was not cargo. Mm-hmm. And the boat had tankage for 2,500 gallons of water. That's about 9,500 liters. That's a lot of water.
A lot of water.
Yeah. Plus they also had fishing gear on board. Cause remember, he did fishing charters. Mm-hmm. So food and water were not going to be an issue on this cruise, it seems to me.
They seem like they could have went a long time with what they had aboard.
Oh, hell yeah. Oh, definitely so. Yeah. And they were probably fishing anyway, because it was about a 2-day cruise up there. And so nothing else to do. Probably half the passengers were fishing, you know, because what the hell else are you going to do, right?
Good point. Yeah.
Yeah.
The voyage to Tokelau was expected to take between 41 and 48 hours. The Joita was scheduled to arrive in the islands on October 5th. And when she didn't show, they waited a little while to sound the alarm. Stuff happens at sea. You can get waylaid.
Oh, yeah.
You get off course a little bit. Like, there's all kinds of different things. You could have an engine issue. It's not that big a deal. Especially back then, they played these schedules pretty loosely. But by the next day, October 6th, a radio message was sent reporting the ship overdue. And that's when people are starting to worry. They want to see if anyone has visuals on it.
Mm.
Radio operators on ships and land were alerted to listen for distress calls, and no one reported any. There was no distress call. And that's because the Joita's radio wasn't connected to its antenna.
Oops.
This didn't get discovered until quite a bit later, obviously.
Yeah, that's what we meant when we said hypothetically they had radio contact, but in reality. So there was a major, major search for about a week. Planes from the New Zealand Air Force searched about 100,000 square miles of ocean between Apia and the Tokelau's and, you know, all around there. They found no sign of the Joita or her lifeboats. But then on November 10th, 1955, this is 5 weeks after her non-appearance in the Tokelau's, the crew of the merchant ship Tuvalu spotted Joita more than 600 miles west from where she was supposed to be. So she was drifting north of Vanua Levu, which is, if you don't know where that is, it's actually...
I do not.
No, I don't know either. I wouldn't know either if not for this story. But it's just northeast of Fiji, if that helps you a little better.
Yeah.
So, okay. The ship was partially submerged, listing heavily to port, about 45 degrees to port, which meant that a significant part of the deck, about half the deck, was underwater. There was no trace of the passengers or the crew at all.
Yeah.
And the boat carried a dinghy and also three life rafts, but these were also all gone.
Hmm.
Yeah, right?
They were also missing the ship's logbook, sextant, chronometer, and compasses. Dusty Miller was also known to keep a few guns on board. I'm going to talk about this later, too. And those were also gone. So it looked like the passengers and crew had abandoned ship. And this would make sense if your ship is sinking, but remember, the Joita was unsinkable. So why would they abandon the boat?
Yeah, that is the big mystery, isn't it? Yeah. A later inquiry also found that 4 tons of cargo was missing, Also, the ship's radio was tuned to 2182 kilohertz, which is the International Marine Distress Channel. That makes sense. Examined it closely, they found a break in the cable between the radio and the antenna. But unfortunately, the cable had been painted over, which hid the break in the wire. And I'm sure that they were probably thinking this very thought, you know, on the board, well, nobody, why are we getting no response to our distress signals? Let's check this wire. Oh, it looks okay. Well, unfortunately, they should have checked it a little harder, I guess. But that break is what did them in, that little break that they couldn't see. Not having that connected to their aerial, that meant that that limited the range of their radio to maybe 2 miles. Mm. And not very much. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, no wonder nobody ever heard them. Must have been
a nightmare.
Yeah, it must have been awfully frustrating for them. But I don't know. Yeah. I don't know exactly how this could have happened, though. I mean, because if the break had been there for so long that it actually had gotten painted over, then that meant that Dusty's radio really wasn't working worth a damn for a considerable amount of time. How did he not notice this?
That's a good question.
You know, how did he not notice this? Maybe he just never used his radio. I don't know. But it's a major negligence on his part, I think. But
I'd go you one more than that, Joe. I didn't really think about this till we were discussing this. When I read your script, it didn't really occur to me. But if his radio only had a range of 2 miles, how is that even usable in the South Pacific?
Yeah, it's not really good for anything. I mean,
it makes me question actually that aspect of the story. How would he radio port? You don't radio port when you're just a mile out, right? When you radio ahead to say that you're coming in, how would he contact other ships? It seems like if that thing had been busted, so you're saying this had been busted, well, I guess we don't know how long, but long enough that it had been painted over.
Yeah.
Unless it got painted recently.
Maybe it was a very recent situation. And I don't know.
Maybe
again, this is a long time ago. It's 1955. And maybe people just didn't really use their radios that much in those days. You know, I don't know.
Maybe not. I don't know.
I don't know. I mean, I just don't know. But it's still, it just seems to me that that's something that, radio is a really key piece of gear. And I would want to test mine and make damn sure that it worked and worked well. You know, seriously.
I just be really curious. It's hard to imagine that he could have gone any length of time without having to make a radio call over a distance of more than 2 miles.
Yeah.
It seems like that problem would have become apparent very quickly. But maybe I'm wrong. Maybe you're right. I can't really connect it back to any theory anybody has about the Joita, but it is a weird detail.
It is a weird little detail. And then, of course, in fairness to Dusty, maybe this was a very recent thing. Maybe he had just had a little work done on the boat. And maybe, who knows, maybe somebody actually deliberately sabotaged it, although God knows why. It's not known if
it's a weird way to sabotage it, but maybe, yeah.
Yeah, it's not known that he actually had any enemies or anything like that. But maybe, yeah, somebody cut the cable and then painted it over to hide the break. Maybe that's what happened. I don't know.
Or maybe he just had one of his massive crew working on painting the boat.
That's true too, yeah. But anyway, so our boat, even though it was halfway sunk when it was found, the hull was actually in really good shape. There was, of course, a leak, but it actually was not in the hull. But it turns out that some of that really cool non-corroding galvy pipe that we talked about earlier that the Navy installed back in 1943 had finally given up the ghost.
Ooh.
Turns out, galvy, when they first started going nuts installing it in boats and houses and stuff like that, it was kind of seen to be the shiz. But as I discovered in my old house, for example, it has a tendency to rust right through. And I found a few pipes in my house that were totally rusted right through.
Galvy. Yeah, galvanized pipe will last quite a while, but it will not last forever.
But so our ship's engines use seawater for cooling. And so the intake pipe, which is, of course, galvy, the intake pipe for the port engine had rusted through and it started letting water in. And normally the ship's bilge pumps probably could have handled the leakage. But the pumps on the Joita, unfortunately, did not have strainers on their intakes. So, yeah, another piece of negligence perhaps here, you know. There was a pattern of negligence
here. Right?
Yeah, there is. Yeah. The bilge pumps did not have strainers on them. So the pumps got clogged with crap, of course, and they stopped working.
Yeah. At some point, the water rose above the bilge level and into the engine room, and the crew noticed. We know they noticed because an auxiliary pump had been rigged in the engine room, mounted on a plank of wood between the main engines. However, it had not been connected. Now, your theory, and I'm with you on this, but I'm going to credit this one to you, is that the starboard engine probably quit working right as they were about to connect it and start pumping water out of the boat, right? That's the idea?
That's one possibility, or it's possible if they noticed it earlier and they rigged it up and had it going and pumping and everything, but it wasn't quite keeping up with the water coming in, and so eventually the water rose high enough to kill the starboard engine. And then they disconnected it so they could work on the starboard engine to try to get it going again, maybe. Okay. But I don't know, one or the other. But it's nice that they actually had an auxiliary pump aboard. It would have been nice if it also
at least they got some stuff right.
Huh? Yeah, no, it would have been nice though if they had also had, like, say, a portable generator they could have had running up on deck to power the auxiliary pump, maybe. Yeah, the only engines that they had, they actually had auxiliary engines down below in the engine spaces. Besides our two main engines, they had auxiliaries as well.
Yeah.
But they were all immersed in water and wouldn't run. So
kind of defeats the purpose.
Yeah. So it was kind of a conundrum, you know. They needed to do was pump the water out, and they could easily pump the water out if their pumps were working, and their pumps wouldn't work unless the engines were working, and the engines aren't going to work until the water's pumped out. Damn it. Totally. Tough one. Yeah.
This is a detail that I was not super familiar with and that I found pretty interesting.
Yeah.
There was damage to the superstructure.
Yeah, there was. Yeah.
A canvas awning had been rigged on top of the deckhouse behind the bridge.
Yeah, now that to me is interesting, because we'll get into that later in our theories, of course, but that would indicate to me, as far as the damage, I mean, it probably just being weeks at sea, especially just wallowing and taking waves of beam and everything like that, getting tossed around. This probably accounts for a lot of the damage that was done to the boat. But it's the awning that had been rigged on top
of
the
boat. That
says something to me. It says something to me that they rigged something for shade.
Yeah, that's, I think you're right.
Which is an indicator.
That's probably what they've been
doing with it. Yeah. But anyway, we'll talk a little bit more about that in our theories section, I think.
Yeah, we will.
Yeah.
So there's some barnacle growth high above the usual waterline on the port side, which indicated that the Joyita had its port side list going for a long time.
Yeah.
Like probably since right after its disappearance.
About 5 weeks worth of barnacle growth there. And the starboard engine below decks was found to be covered by a mattress. Port engine's clutch was still partially disassembled. No change there. The mattress, I'm not sure about what was going on with the mattress. Maybe, I don't know. Maybe the two of mattress. Weird. Maybe the only thing I can think of is maybe they threw a mattress over the top of the engine so a crew member could sit or lay on top of the engine while trying to work on it and get it restarted, maybe.
Okay. That makes sense.
Yeah. That's about the only thing I can think of here. And it really, otherwise, it just sounds like an uncomfortable situation. I'm sure the engine room was probably mostly filled with water. It would be tough going to try to work on that engine.
Well, it's also odd thing to, yeah. No, that makes sense. I like your theory. Because, the other thing I was saying is like, well, if it's meaningless and it just ended up there, it's not the kind of thing that's going to be in the engine room or near the engine room anyway. So it says there's something intentional going on. Someone put a mattress up there for some reason.
So that's about all I can think of about that.
Anything I got.
Yeah. All right.
The electric clocks on board the ship had stopped at 10:25, and the switches for the cabin lighting and navigation lights were on. This led some people to conclude that the ship's power was lost at 10:25 at night.
Yeah.
Apparently, I think that's reasonable. What do you think about that?
Well, according to, like, if you read the Wikipedia page, for example, and some other sources, they claim that the lights, the navigation lights, the clocks were all wired into the ship's generator, and so that's why they think the generator stopped running at, say, 10:25, because the nav lights were turned on, that would indicate that they were running at night. But the thing about it is I can't imagine they actually did have this stuff wired in directly to the generator, because the generator is going to go on and off. They should be connected to the ship's batteries, and then the batteries will get charged. I mean, right? And then
could they have done this in an emergency scenario?
What, like switch them directly to the generators?
Yeah, like if the batteries were messed up for some reason, waterlogged, whatever.
They could have, but if it's the emergency is that they flooded, the engine room is flooded, and the engine has stopped running. That is the emergency here. And so your best bet is to keep them connected to the batteries. But I don't know. I mean, to me, the fact that the switches were for the cabin lighting and the nav lights were turned on might indicate they lost their power at night. It could also indicate that somebody wanted to see if there was any juice left in the batteries, so they flipped a switch or two to see if any lights came on.
Yeah,
maybe, you know, maybe that's what they were doing. I don't know, but so it doesn't.
You've done that, right? Like when you're you have a power outage.
Yeah,
so you're on your house flipping all your light switches like an idiot, mm-hmm. and the power comes back on, and you're fast asleep,
and you're blinded. I've done that. Like you wake up in the middle of the night, and the lights are on, and you're
it's terrifying. You know,
I know.
What's
what the hell?
And I've done it.
I know. So, and I always have my gun in my hand, and there's a few bullet holes in the wall. But anyway, no, that's like, so
there's one other tantalizing clue that I'm really into.
Yeah.
I think this one's fascinating. A doctor's bag was found on the boat, but there wasn't much in it. Mm-hmm. Just a stethoscope and a scalpel plus four bandages that were bloodstained, and they were in the doctor's bag. That's kind of odd. I don't think a doctor would do that.
That's really odd. And which is interesting to me, because it indicates that the doctor or whoever was using his stuff actually wanted to save those bandages, even though they've been used. I mean, I can't say that's exactly what that person intended. He stuffed them in the bag. Maybe not, but it indicates to me that they were saving these things. But this doesn't make any sense unless you've been at sea for a while and you're anticipating possibly being at sea for a good while longer. Maybe that would make you think twice about just throwing these bandages overboard. Maybe you want to hang on to them instead.
Yeah.
Maybe.
Maybe
it's something more random than that, and somebody just like stuffed him in the doctor's bag just to get him out of sight or something.
Or if maybe God forbid that whoever's doctor's bag that was wasn't using it, and someone a little less careful had decided, I don't know, medical crap, it all goes in there.
Yeah, maybe that too. Could be. There was a doctor on board the boat that we don't know. We of course don't know his fate. I mean, he could have been.
That was his bag.
I'm sure it was, even though I'm sure, that doesn't mean it's proven beyond a shadow of a doubt, but it probably was his bag, but you don't know though. Fate is a strange mistress, as they say, or something like that. I mean, it might have been a doctor would be a very, very useful thing to have when you're marooned on a boat at sea for a month or so. So he probably was the first one to get it in the neck, the way things work. You know what I'm saying? He probably like fell overboard and drowned like the first day. But anyway, but no, who knows? I mean, they did have some medical supplies in the hold. That was part of their cargo. Mm-hmm. But I'm not sure how easy these were to get to. And maybe they'd been ruined by seawater. And so maybe that's why maybe they had medical supplies, but those did not include bandages. So maybe that's why they decided to hang on to the bandages. But again, I'm just inferring this. I don't know for a fact that they were hanging onto those bandages versus just using that bag as a wastebasket. You know, I don't know.
Yeah, you got me.
Yeah.
Now there was fuel in the Joyita's tanks.
There still was plenty of it, apparently.
Huh. Yeah. So the boat had a capacity of about 3,000 gallons of diesel. From the remaining amount in the tanks, it was calculated the boat had traveled about 245 miles. That's 400 kilometers for those of you who use the correct measurement of distance before the engine quit. So, so they went to about 245 miles, which actually would have put them just within 50 miles or 80 kilometers of Tokelau.
Yeah.
Which, I mean, that's really close to port.
Yeah, they made it a good deal most of the way. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's sort of just, you know, guesstimated that leak had probably started sometime after 9 p.m., 10:25 perhaps, on the second night of the voyage.
Yeah. So there was, and I think the way they figured that out, there was an inquiry into this thing, an official maritime inquiry. And maybe they figured that the leak had started at this time, 9 p.m., the second night of the voyage, based on the volume of water that they measured coming through the leaky, rusted-out pipe after they got it back to port like and dried the boat out. Yeah, maybe that's
based
how they
on
figured
the
it.
Fuel consumption.
Yeah, it could have been. Well, yeah, but they've got to figure out, like, you know, how long between the time the leak starts and it lets enough water into the boat to kill the engine.
Right. Okay.
Right. And so they got to have an idea of the volume of water that could come through that leaky pipe, I'm assuming. And working backwards, they could say, okay, it was this many hours of leakage that killed the engine, therefore it must have been 9 p.m. the night before. Okay, maybe, I don't know.
Something but, like that.
Yeah, there is. So,
Joe, real quick before we move on, I do want to ask you a question. I'm sorry to interrupt, but just to clear this up in my own brain. What was Tokelau like in 1955?
I have no idea. That's a great question. See, it was fairly undeveloped.
80 miles of Tokelau, I like to think this was a port with enough traffic that they would have been having to enter, shipping lanes, travel lanes, and would have been 80 miles is, by boat is not that far. It seems like they would have been really easy to sight, especially after they were reported missing.
No, Tokelau was actually a even today, I believe it's very, very lightly populated. We're talking some. It's a collection of several very tiny little islands and atolls and stuff. And there's just not very many people living there, and probably a lot fewer back in 1955. And just not a hell of a lot of commerce and traffic heading that way. And so, I think that's probably why. Or it might be that, there was traffic heading that way, but it was from from the other islands in the Tokelau Archipelago, and they just weren't going that particular north-south route that our boat was on.
Which part of Tokelau they were going to?
I can't remember which island it was. It was, kind of starts with an F, like Fokelau Harbor or something like that.
Fokelau Atoll.
Yeah. Oh, is that
it's
it?
The southernmost point. It's going to be the one closest to.
Yeah. So that's where they were. Yeah. That's where they're officially supposed to go. That's where they were noted to be missing.
Okay. And, so it's pretty remote. I don't know. Yeah. So maybe 80 miles off of that was something people wouldn't notice.
Yeah. And they, of course our boat, maybe Dusty, besides all those other wonderful attributes, maybe he was also a lousy navigator and they were well off course. I was wondering about that too. Maybe that's possible too. Remember, they didn't have GPS back in those days.
Nope.
So
you need to be meticulous about your charts. You're getting in trouble.
Yeah. And so there's that. But back to the inquiry, there was an official inquiry. And the official report, by the way, of this maritime inquiry is theoretically at least available from the Library of Australia. And I tried to order a copy and went to their website and typed it all in and everything, but I never got my copy. But at least I'd be a lot angrier, but at least they didn't charge my credit card.
Well, that's good.
Yeah, that's good. But I'm a little disappointed though. I never got it, and they never even so much as
cool to see.
Yeah, it would have been very cool. Yeah,
record requests. By the way, just in case any of you ever want to try to get into this, into the field of investigative journalism, are the biggest effing headache. Mm-hmm. I've tried to do them a few times for this podcast.
Yeah, no, it's difficult. Yeah, I mean, these guys, they work in the bureaucracy and stuff. They don't have any real. A lot of them, I don't want to put everybody down because some of them I know work hard and try hard to do a good job, but a lot of them don't have that much incentive to.
It's just a lot of incentive to give to spend time and effort out of your day, out of your employer, out of the government's day to give some podcaster in Portland your records.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah. So
they drag their heels and.
Yeah. Yeah. It's not. Anyway,
moving on. From
Let's talk about the inquiry's findings.
Yeah. I want to know what they had to say.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. What do you think? Tell us what you know about what they knew.
What do I know? Well, okay.
Yeah.
So the inquiry found that the Joyita was generally in poor condition. Pretty much continued that it was.
Yeah.
Might have been seaworthy, but boy, it really could have used some attention to detail. They concluded that the fate of the passengers and the crew was, and I'm quoting here,
inexplicable on the evidence submitted at the inquiry.
Unquote.
So the report noted that the ship's dinghy and life rafts were missing, but that it would not make sense for the crew and passengers to voluntarily abandon ship. The ship didn't sink. It was listing, but it couldn't really sink.
Yeah.
Because of the cork and its construction.
As we mentioned just a few minutes ago, Plus, they had those 80 empty fuel drums on board in their hold.
That's true, yeah. That would have added some buoyancy right
there. A lot of buoyancy. Yeah, between all that cork and all those drums, they had buoyancy up the wazoo.
Right.
Yeah.
The inquiry had no trouble, on the other hand, figuring out why the boat sprang a leak and flooded. The Joyita had no watertight bulkheads, and this is a shame. I'm guessing that it's not. Not entirely unusual on a smaller boat like this.
Yeah, I guess it would have been good, but I don't know. It would have been good to have at least one because, if you have watertight bulkheads, you can close your watertight doors and localize that leakage to one part of the boat instead of flooding the entire boat. So it would have been really handy, but they didn't have that.
It was a smaller boat. It was an older boat.
Yeah.
So the inquiry's hypothesis was that water could have gradually flooded the lower decks, and as the vessel began to sink lower into the water, the engine would have not been able to maintain enough speed to steer. the Joyita would have then taken on a heavy swell beam on the side. So basically, like, it would have come, you know, when you talk about beam on, it meant, you know, so you're talking about swell, that's like a wave.
Yeah.
A wave that doesn't crest is called a swell. Beam on means that you're hitting it right on the side.
Yeah. Which you don't want to do. Yeah.
No, you do. You really want to avoid that. You always want to go, you know, bow straight into anything, any swell or wave.
Yeah, that's why losing power in the middle of a heavy seas like a storm is really bad news. Yep. Really, really bad news. You want control over that so you can keep it headed into the waves. And of course, if it took a wave on the side like that, a beam, then that could cause the cargo to shift, which is bad news. Which might leave it with that heavy list that we were just talking about.
Right. And that flooding, you know, that listing and the flooding, it probably would have sunk most boats, but the Joyita stayed afloat due to her cork-lined hull and those fuel drums we talked about.
Uh-huh.
Inquiry also had a few pretty choice words for Captain Dusty Miller, the Welshman. Mm-hmm. They found him reckless for setting out across the open ocean with only one ocean navigable engine.
Yeah.
Because he did have those auxiliary engines, right?
Well, they're not auxiliary. They were auxiliaries for just turning generators to power the refrigeration units and other systems on the boat. Yeah, no, they did not do that. There were only two engines that turned screws. Yeah.
Right. And one of them was totally out. So, like I said,
the one that was totally out still ran. It just didn't have a functioning clutch.
Okay, technically you are correct, but I stand by my statement. If you don't have an engine with no clutch, it's not doing anything, right? Like, think about your car, right?
Yeah, like I said, if the starboard engine had gone out and they could have theoretically swapped parts over to the clutch in the port engine and gotten that going, that would have taken a little time. That's not something you'd say want to be doing in the middle of a storm.
I really prefer not to be on a boat that had, you know, two half engines that hopefully the crew could kludge together into one full engine. I'd rather not do that in good conditions, in fair weather. In a storm, that'd be a nightmare.
I think that what I would have done if I had been Dusty and I had no parts, I would have found a way to jury rig and just basically bypass the clutch and basically bolt the a clutch works, you know, it sort of engages and there's a pressure plate and a flywheel and all that stuff. It's sort of for easing the connection between the screw and the engine. And so I would have found a way to just basically just attach those things solidly. And so when the engine turns over, the screw turns, period. There ain't no disconnecting the screw from the engine. And that would have been a good emergency backup. But
I guess so.
I don't know.
I see what you're saying from my limited understanding of engines. I don't know enough about boats, ships, maritime engines to really...
I don't know.
So it's also,
let's see what else.
Those pumps also had no strainers on their intakes, right?
Yeah. And
he had noticed that the radio was busted.
He had not noticed his busted radio, bilge pump, strainers. Yeah. He probably should have inspected the boat hauled and should have inspected the piping and the bilges and stuff too, right?
Yeah.
Probably.
When you read about these kinds of things, you know, almost all the time, you know, I don't know, this is the first thing that popped in my head, like why things happened the way they happened at Chernobyl in 1986. It wasn't one thing.
No.
It was a whole bunch of things. And it ran just fine for a long time until somebody, you know, basically pushed the whole thing too far and all of the failures in the system came apart. To me, that's always what's scary about things like boats, you know, sailing, is that, you know, you miss one thing, it's not so big. You miss two things, it's not so big. You miss three things and suddenly that's compounded and it's worse than the sum of the parts and you're in the middle of the ocean and you're in trouble, buddy.
Yeah, I know. And so the three big things were, of course, the leaky pipe, the non-functioning bilge pumps and the non-functioning radio all together. Yeah, bad news. Yeah. Really, really bad news.
Compound to make a really scary situation.
Yeah, if just one of those things had not failed, like say the bilge pumps or the radio, then you know, things would have turned out differently, I think.
I think so, yeah.
But it's been said that Dusty Miller had been having financial difficulties. And so this might explain the condition of the boat. He probably just couldn't afford to have it hauled out and worked on, because that's kind of what you got to do. I mean, you got to have these things hauled in a shipyard, and that's expensive to have that done.
Well, it's expensive to do, and then there would also be a loss of revenue. And this isn't working.
That's true too. So
Dusty was making money off of it, so in addition to having to pay money to have it fixed up, there'd be a loss of income, which of course is what you would in principle be using to pay for it. It's much smaller, but I've been in this situation with some of my electronics that I have used in different points of my life to make some of my money, right?
Yeah.
If you've got clients and your computer dies, you need that computer to finish getting pay from your clients, and you can't get a new computer or fix your computer until you get your client's pay, and the whole thing becomes a financial nightmare.
It is a conundrum.
Yep. Nah. So I could see that happening with Dusty's boat. But with that, I think we are going to have to take a break, and we're going to return later in the week with our theories about what could have happened to the MV Joyita. So stay tuned for that. We'll have it out real soon.
Mm-hmm.
The Shocking Details can be found at www.theshockingdetails.com. We're on Twitter at Shocking Details. For discussion of episodes and more, our Facebook group is facebook.com/groups/shockingdetailspodcast/. Or you can email us at theshockingdetailspodcast@gmail.com. And if you like the podcast, please consider giving us a like and a positive review and letting people know about us.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.